Hey, podcast listeners, it's Michael Shelley here. Scott Fagan is our guest today, and what we aired was just a small portion of this. It was two of the songs. I think it was about a half hour. What you've got here is an hour and 20 minutes of Scott Fagan and I at WFMU. And this is, much longer, much more drawn out. It's nice to have the podcast where we can air the sort of longer form stuff. So you get five songs here and all kinds of interesting Scott Fagan stories. South Atlantic Blues has just come out on the St. Cecilia Knows label. You can check scottfagan.com for information. This is sort of long, so I won't keep you too much on this introduction, but interesting guy, interesting story, and you really get to hear it pretty in-depth here from the man himself. Check WFMU.org/Michael for the list of upcoming guests, the archives of all the old shows. They're yours to listen to for free whenever you like. That's about it, folks. I will talk to you soon. Here is Scott Fagan. All right, we are up here in Studio B, and Scott Fagan is my guest. It's been a long journey for you to get here, both metaphorically and literally. I know you had some path train problems this morning, but I'm really pleased to hear you. Your record, South Atlantic Blues, was just re-released for the first time. It originally came out, I think, in 1968. And I was telling you just a minute ago, I saw it in the bin upstairs, and I popped it in the CD player. And, the very first song really, really hit me. Just the way, the sound of it, the presentation of it, what you were saying, the performance of it. It's very fully committed, and it kind of has that line that I love so much, which is pop music, but presented with a little bit of a twist to it. And so I'm happy it's been re-released, and I'm happy it brings you all the way here. And welcome to WFMU, and good morning.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and I want to say hi to all those folks that have been waiting for me to show up at WFMU for these many years. WFMU, for the longest while, was the only station playing my stuff in the state. Apparently they play it more overseas. But I hear from listeners, WFMU listeners, they played South Atlantic Blues. Oh, they played In Your Hands. Oh, you ought to get over there. Here now, and I'm saying hi to them, and I'm thanking them for their grace and their patience.
So, as I said, this was just re-released on this label.
Well, it'll be released on the 20th.
On the 20th. St. Cecilia Knows. I think it's going to air after the 20th.
Do you know who St. Cecilia is?
No, who is it?
The patron saint of musicians.
Oh, excellent. Well, perfect. This was just re-released, and I was telling you that it has a nice booklet inside, and I was reading your story, and it's a quite interesting story, just full of drama and twists and turns, and lots of opportunity for you not to be here today, along the way, and here you are. So I want to talk about that a little bit. First of all, where were you born?
On 52nd Street in New York City, in the time that it was jazz heaven.
Yeah.
My pop was a tenor man, tenor saxophone, and a singer, a great, great singer. And he came up sitting in with who they call Prez, that's Lester Young. And Lady Day, that's Billie Holiday, or Eleanora Fagan, as we refer to her. So my mother was a jazz baby, a modern dancer. My pop was a young bebop tenor man, singer. And so I was born right there and grew up in and amongst creative people.
And so you end up moving with your mom first to the Virgin Islands, is that right?
Yes.
At what age?
Early on.
Four or so?
I was five.
Four or five. Yeah. So why is the first question?
Well, she and her twin sister were both modern dancers and wanted out of what they call the rat race. There was an arts colony in St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, that had been started by Camille Pissarro, who was the father of Impressionism. So folks had been there, painters, poets.
And this is the late 1940s, right?
Well, this is 1950. But Camille Pissarro is 1850 or something.
But you moved down there in 1950, so was it a beatnik scene? What did it feel like?
Very bohemian. On the other hand, but the St. Thomas in particular has been a crossroads of the world for many, many hundreds of years. It is the best natural harbor in the West Indies, and that was very important in shipping days, sailing days particularly. And it is very multicultural. It always has been, and it is. So if there's a bohemian scene, there's also a classical European scene. There's also culturally English folks and Irish and Scottish folks and a large colony of French people left over from Napoleon's army.
And is that all in music there? Is that
it
when
is.
It went back then?
It is.
Can you remember first hearing music down there?
Well, I can, but there's also the African influence, the Calypso influence, the Spanish Caribbean influence. I do remember music. I remember music from my very, very earliest consciousness.
Was it a good... So this atmosphere sounds, you know, it's certainly escaping the rat race. Was it, as a kid, did you feel secure at that time down there? Was that...
Monetarily secure?
Any? I don't know how kid, you know, however in your head, your little kid head.
My little kid head? My little kid head was very much distracted by music. My mother was alcoholic and became more and more acutely alcoholic. She married 7 times. Many of those were local people of color, alcoholic men. So I grew up in an extraordinary mix of beauty and violence, of the greatest sort of natural affluence and desperation. But that's the way it is, and that's the way it naturally was, and the work I do naturally comes out of that. When I was very young, we had to flee St. Thomas and wound up in Puerto Rico, a place called El Fanguito.
Why'd you have to flee St. Thomas?
Bill collectors and such, alcoholic folks don't pay the bills often.
So you wind up in Puerto Rico. There's a photograph in the liner notes of the place where you live, the neighborhood, El Fanguito.
El Fanguito.
And wow,
it's
unbelievable how crazy. I mean, tell the folks what we're talking about.
Well, El Fanguito was the number one slum in all of Spanish America. And that's saying a lot. Certainly in the Spanish Caribbean. It was built on a mud flat, and you build houses out of tin cans, flattened cans, and cardboard, and there wasn't much plastic around in those days. But any and everything you can, a scrap of wood, this, that, and the next thing, and many of those folks were aspiring, but alcoholism is fairly rampant in that population, certainly then also. So I think the first or second day that we were there, I saw for the very first time the thing that set me and my commitment to writing. I saw naked young children digging stuffs out of garbage cans and putting it directly in their faces, in their mouths. Beautiful little girls, beautiful little boys. And I was not much older than they were. And we were in difficult circumstances, but not that. And so I thought to myself in that moment, Jesus, if the people in America knew about this, they'd help. I know they'd help. And I got to tell them about it. And that idea found a root in my soul. And so when I write stuff, I mean it. When I sing, I mean it. That's why I sound like I mean it, because I mean it.
Yeah, you sound committed. You're fully committed to your lyrics. So were you playing a guitar? Were you writing songs at this point or thinking about it?
Well, that is the first time I thought about writing anything. And the hardest thing, really, I think I ever did is learn how to write good, well-constructed song.
When's the first time you actually started to learn an instrument?
Well, the instrument is the vocal. I began to sing very early on. I had stowed away on two separate airplanes when I was 16 to come to America to begin my recording career. And I thought the plane was going to... I was on an Eastern flight. Thought it was going to Miami, but it wound up in Baltimore.
How do you stow away on a plane? I mean, these days it's
two.
Obviously
I
a different
away
story.
On two of them.
But twice, my grandfather stowed away from Ireland to get here and end up in Australia. And,
wow!
And they sent him back. And
man after me own heart.
And
there.
He did it again, and he finally got to New York. How do you? I mean, do you just walk on like you own the place?
Or? Well, that's how the first airline was Carabair, which was a airline out of Puerto Rico, and it was in St. Thomas. That one, I just jumped the fence. They were announcing the flight, and I just jumped the fence and. Walked on the plane and sat down next to a lovely young soul. And I was a fairly lovely young soul myself. And I said, I'm not stowing away. If anybody asks, tell them we're married. And she said, okay.
Why not? Scott Fagan is our guest. And South Atlantic Blues is the record. I think this is a great time to hear a song, if you wouldn't mind favoring us with something.
I'd like to favor you with the song that I wrote for that girl, but I never did write a thing for her.
Still time.
Yes. She'll be the next one. This is the song you referred to earlier, In My Head. Black and white past the grass, for the mass, last endless glass of wine. Somebody's eye man is watching the high man walk down the line. And his shadow do seem to be mine. Is it something, 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 something I've said? Oh no, it's something, something. In my head, this city street show cracks like a storm, and so I wonder, why is it so strange to rearrange the clouds? Over and under, myself and I have always seen the sun.
she want the sky instead? Something in my head. Something I read. This winter morning is so cold for her in her cotton dress. Things went her way when they used to say, "Oh, you child of bliss." But lately, you see, she's been counting on me, and I must confess, something is dead. And I know it's something.
Scott Fagan is here, and that is the lead-off track from South Atlantic Blues, just recently re-released. Wow. So you finally do get to New York through legal means. I think you worked your way across, sailing a boat, working your way to get to Florida, and then played some music in Florida and took a bus up to New York. And so now it's early 1960s.
No. So I got... I was gigging in Ireland with a little trio, the Urchins.
Great name.
And
this is original songs?
Yeah. A mix. Spied a bohemian-looking wench across the room who had already spied me. And we got to hugging and smooching and... that is the genesis of Stephen.
Your son.
Yes. So he's conceived on a very listing houseboat.
Maybe too much information, but...
Listing a lot. we did everything we could, all the gigs. I mean, we absolutely did everything possible in the islands, culminating with a great show in the local ballpark with the mighty Lord Kitchener, who in Caribbean terms is a calypso god. And Kitchener gave me his blessing. My boy, you got the goods. Now go and give it to the world.
So what was the urchin sound? I mean, was it...
Well, I was the lead singer, so you just...
It's a lot like this. Was it more Beatles-y because it was that time, was it?
No. God bless the Beatles, no. You will look far and wide to find my influences. They are Edith Piaf. They are Eleanora Fagan. They are Johnny Ray. They are every hillbilly song that ever broke a heart. We had one radio station in the islands, and they had to play music for everyone. So the mix was fantastic. Maybe a bit like you guys. So there was martial music, there was classical European, there was Broadway show tunes, there was jibaro music coming from Puerto Rico and Cuba, There was the most raw calypso music coming up from Trinidad. And, of course, we had our own calypsonians. We had all our own everything. And there was rock and roll. And rock and roll, there was a rock and roll show for maybe an hour a day. But most of it came fuzzy in and out in the late night. You'd have your little transistor radio and you'd hear song magic. You'd hear the marching song of what we viewed as a revolutionary generation fading in and out from New Orleans, from North Carolina, from Chicago, from New York. It was fantastic. Anyway, so naturally, any set of music was impacted by all of that. And I think you can see that it's the English that rediscovered South Atlantic blues. So the first reviews are all referenced by English writers. So they say David Bowie, but David Bowie is no influence of mine. I think I've been recording before David. And Donovan, God bless him, beautiful writer, Catch the Wind. I still do a medley of Catch the Wind, just beautiful. Scott Walker, God bless him, but I have no influence from Scott Walker. And other English folk that they relate to. Well, Scott sounds like, but doesn't sound like he's reminiscent of. And, you know, people say these things, so we have a frame of reference. But if you don't know Lord Kitchener or the Mighty Sparrow, then you wouldn't recognize that influence, or Lord Melody.
You hear all of them on WFMU.
And Lucho Gatica, who was a great singer out of Ecuador.
Okay, so you're playing in the Urchins. Yeah. You meet this girl, and how do you get to New York City?
She goes back to the States. I get a gig as a bilge rat on a sailboat called the Success, a 50-foot sloop, and we sailed up. My friend and I, two bilge rats. This sloop was on the last leg of an around-the-world tour. There was this Irish captain and his two little girls, a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they needed crew to help. And so we signed on, left at dawn on July the 2nd, 1964, sailed down to the harbor. A lot of folks say I should have sailed east, but I sailed west, and east because they think that the English would have received me in a positive way. A month and a half later, arrived in Coconut Grove, which was a fairly hip place down in South Florida. Was singing in a place called the House of Pegasus in Fort Lauderdale. And a group of young girls formed a little Scott Fagan fan club and scraped up $50 and gave it to me to go to New York.
The liner notes for the CD say that you arrived, I'm paraphrasing, arrived in New York City with 11 cents.
I did.
The first stop was to go see Doc Pomus, and he signed you to a contract on the spot.
I had one telephone number, and I had 11 cents. And I called that number, and that number was Doc Pomus. Artsy friends of my mother's had passed the number along of a guy who, a friend of a friend of a friend's cousin's wife's uncle, wrote songs with sometimes. And he was certainly somebody in the music business, so call him. So I did. And he said, all right, well, come on over. So I went over. He was living at the Forest Hotel on 49th Street and Broadway. That's directly across the street from the Brill Building. come on over. So I went over there, and he said, all right, let me see what you got. And so there's a piano bench. Doc had polio and didn't have use of his legs. So he's sitting in the middle of this enormous triple-wide bed, wrapped in a sheet. And he says, let me hear what you got.
He's naked otherwise, right?
Yeah. So there's a piano bench. Sit there. I sit there, and I sing him three songs. And at the end of it, he says, okay, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to assign you to personal management, and I'm going to assign you to my production company. Go downstairs and tell them to give you a room. Come back here and let's get started.
Yeah, and you had 1 cent in your pocket.
And you know, now I had a hotel room.
Yeah, it's just an amazing.
Amazing
situation. Did you see the movie Inside Llewellyn Davis?
No.
An interesting movie about it takes place.
Yeah,
during,
I know.
And there's a character kind of based on Doc Pomus in the movie.
So they say, yeah. Or Herb Gart. Huh. Who was also
who crosses
a manager
your path
of mine.
Soon, yeah. Okay, so
I'd like to see the movie. I don't dismiss it.
I loved it except for the last bit. That's all I'll say. I don't want to ruin it, but I loved it otherwise.
That was an interesting time, man, in the village. It was really something.
Yeah. So you start working with Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann, who's his partner, a little bit younger and closer to your age.
Yes.
And they're, you know...
Is all this in the liner notes?
A lot of it is, yeah.
Well, why does anybody gonna interview me in the future? What do you think, Matt?
There's always more.
There's a lot more.
So you're working with Doc Pomus, and they're writing songs, and they're... They're from that old school where they are always working a deal and a single for this label, and they've got a lot going on, and they're managing it. And was watching that all go on, coming from, you know, the Virgin Islands in a totally different life, was that a mind blow, or?
Did you hear me stomach singing for a burrito? Good Lord.
Scott's stomach is acting up.
Yeah. No, it's just hungry. It was fantastic to me, but I was immediately in it. It wasn't watch this, Scotty. It was come here, sit down. We're working on this. Very early on, I wrote a tune with Doc and Mort called "Cry Till My Tears Run Dry." Irma Thomas recorded it.
I just saw Irma a couple of weeks ago. She didn't do that tune, but it's a great record.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I'm sure we'll play it on this show. So with those guys, you recorded a few sessions for a couple of different labels. Nothing happened until Bang Records put out a 45 by you. But you already were doing a lot. You were real busy. And your first sort of success, you know, professional releases are coming out. And then you kind of eventually part ways with Doc. You're playing in the village, and like you said, your new manager comes and sees you and says, according to the liner notes, you'll be as big as Elvis in
6 months. Bigger than Presley. And I manage Buffy St. Marie, he says to me. And the bigger than Presley was interesting, but the Buffy St. Marie part.
Maybe you can meet Buffy St. Marie. So tell
Good Lord, maybe meet. No, I was signing with her expressly for that. Are you familiar with Buffy St. Marie?
Yeah, a little bit, sure.
Oh, my God. What a beautiful looking soul she was. Yeah. Just beautiful.
So tell me about your playing in Greenwich Village. I mean, it's such a story time in the, you know, there was just people playing sets and sets and clubs, and there was that time where this thing was exploding, and there was kind of still a square world and a hipper world, and they were kind of intersecting. And where were you?
I don't know about square and hip intersecting. I don't know about that.
What do you know? Tell me what you saw, what you felt.
It had nothing to do with squares and hip intersecting. I mean, from time to time, we would stagger against a square wench, God bless her, and she would throw her arms around us.
But people were curious, you know. Newspapers and magazines were writing articles about what was going on there, maybe not exactly understanding it from the perspective of a performer, certainly.
You have a wonderful enthusiasm for this.
Does that mean it's I disagree wonderful. With it?
No. It would have been great if you'd been there.
I would wish I could.
Yeah. So So I was a house singer at Steve Paul's Scene for a year, along with Tiny Tim, who was a fantastic character. The Scene was where all the girls from High School of Music and Art, all the fame girls went. Jeez, good Lord, they were beautiful and fantastic. And I liked them, and they liked me. And so I was at the Scene for a year. We didn't get paid. You were paid in kisses and macrobiotic rice.
How did you pay your rent?
Well, you have no rent.
You slept on couches?
No, with the girls. Lord, that's the trade-off. They love you. You love them. I had no earthly idea about how to pay rent for many years. And then I began, I'm jumping ahead. Anyway, so I'm
so Buffy St. Marie's manager comes in and says,
I'm working at the Cafe Gogo for $5 a night alongside Richie Havens and Jimmy James and the Blue Flames.
Jimi Hendrix later.
Yes.
Soon, though.
Well, it was
Were they
Jimmy
great?
James.
I mean, I've heard that that was a great band. I mean, that just...
It was a great blues band. Jimmy was great, absolutely great. Chaz Chandler and the English kicked him up 9 or 10 levels. But before that, he was a funky dude that was just master of the instrument. But we were all underfed, so the energy level is fairly low. You're eating macrobiotic rice and ice cream sodas. You could have all the ice cream sodas you wanted. And whatever chick you could convince to have compassion on your miserable soul and macrobiotic rice. And at the time I was living at the Earl Hotel, which we went from hotel to hotel, young writers, singers. One cheap hotel after the next.
What does cheap mean? What was a week in a hotel those days?
$35.
Oh, wow. In New York City. Wow.
40.
That's amazing.
50. Yeah.
For a nice place. Yeah.
Yeah, for the Roger Williams, which I also lived at. Man, I lived in every one of them. So Herb comes in and he's going to make me bigger than Elvis in 6 months and I'm going to get next to Buffy St. Marie. So I immediately went back to St. Thomas to stay connected. Down the islands and Herb called me. I got a gig for you, Scotty. You got to get there right away. So he sends me a ticket. I jump on the plane. It's 82 degrees, balmy, trade winds, lovely. I jump on the plane and get off in Saratoga, New York.
Saratoga sounds right.
The gig is at a place called the Cafe Lina, which was a great, great venue. I get off and it's 25 degrees below zero at the Cafe Lina. So in those days, you know, I had a gig bag with a big, beautiful pouch in front where you're supposed to have your tuning, your pitch pipe and maybe your extra strings and things. But to make a choice, do you fill it with beer or extra strings? And by default, I went for the alcohol. So I'm up at the Cafe Lina in what's called the green room. The green room is the warm-up room. I'm in the Cafe Lina, and it's time for me to go on. There, about half the windows in the place were broken because the local townsfolk didn't like this progressive hippie joint, and they'd thrown rocks through the windows. So I opened my beer to tune up. That was my tune-up in those days. And the blasted things are frozen solid, solid. Anyway, I had one of the greatest nights of my life there. Two young lesbian women from, I think it's Swarthmore College is in that town. It was 25 below zero, and there was new snow, and I think it was a full moon, and we just became the greatest friends. Nothing beyond that. Just heart-to-heart friends. And we played in the snow and explored the town and just played all night long. I'll never forget them. It was just the most wonderfully touching and tender night. 25 below zero. So we stood close to one another.
Yeah. Do you think you could play us another song, maybe something that night went over gangbusters? I'll remind everybody, Scott Fagan is our guest, and South Atlantic Blues is his new album.
After all these years of trying, soft and slowly go the tear, chase away all my fear. All the broken glass in me, crying. Oh, look at me, look at me, I'm crying. Did you know I've been dying? Soft and slowly go the tears, chase away the why and how. I can stay here and now, crying. No, look at me, I'm crying. Sweet and so satisfying, soft and slowly, slowly go the tears, soft and
this one's called Mademoiselle. When will I see your garden, Mademoiselle?
that I love so well. Orchids and roses, my favorite smell. Take me, you told me, you promised, and I'll never tell. Take me and show me your garden, mademoiselle. Yes, I know there are kings and princes. They line at your gate. Oh, but I love you more. I love you more than they. Let them wait. Orchids and the roses would ease all my hate. Take me, you told me, you promised, before it's too late. Take me and give me your garden. Now we must stop pretending, mademoiselle. Your garden is choking, and your blossoms all fell. Orchids and roses are a funeral smell. Your rouge and your perfumes too heavy, like the stories I tell. We've got nothing to sell, and I'm sorry, mademoiselle. Nothing to sell, and I'm sorry.
Scott Fagan is our guest. So we're talking about the Greenwich Village thing and this new manager, and right around this time you start to make this record. What were the expectations going in to making it, and who's the sound of the record is really appealing to me. It has a real clean sound, but there's a lot going on, and there's interesting choices of instruments that kind of back up the melody or provide counter melodies, and it's clearly arranged, but it's very loose as well. It has a nice middle ground of all of that. Who's doing was that, and what were your expectations for the final product?
Well, Herb, who, you know, I made some humor around a little earlier. Herb is a terrific fellow and a great eye for talent. And had he been more well capitalized, things would be a different world. But Herb was the executive producer. He did the independent production. We did it at MusiCorps Studios, which was on 56th Street. A fantastic engineer, Wiley Brooks. Elmer Gordon was the hands-on producer. Elmer had not long before done a record called Pearls Before Swine, which at that time was a big thing in the underground, quote, underground. Herb was really interested in this young black arranger who was coming up from the South who'd just done Aretha Franklin's album. His name was Horace Ott, O-T-T. So Horace was young and had a wonderful musical education, fairly straight-laced. So Herb put us together and had a writing partner, Jose Kukulis, interesting fellow. His mother was a Venezuelan, illiterate Venezuelan Indian who'd married a Greek dude. So my partner's name was actually Jose Silvio Martinez, but it was Joe Kukulis. Anyway, so we got together with Horace and went over the tunes and worked up this, worked up that.
And did you feel good about it? Because hearing the songs now, you can hear these songs inside of what's on that album, but there's a huge production on top of them.
Well, I can't play all the horn lines and things. I can't. I mean, it's either do that or sing, and I default to singing. It may be that if the record creates some activity, some gigs, maybe we can go out on the road with and play the full arrangements, which would be great fun. But I love to just sing with the guitar also. It's fine. For me, it's the song. It's the singing. So we had... interesting time. In one tune in particular, Tenement Halls, we had this free jazz section.
Yeah.
And
in the middle of the song, there's a part where all heck breaks loose, sort of.
Yeah, it's a free jazz thing that we wanted to put in there to illustrate the craziness and the hopelessness. Joe came out of really hard knocks background also, shoeshine boy from New Haven, Connecticut, with an illiterate mother, a younger brother, and we earned our living peddling tunes. We'd write a song, you take it to this, that, or the next publishing company, you get $50 advance, and then, by God, you write another song and as quickly as you can. So... we worked with Horace. We worked up the arrangement for Tenement Halls. We're in the studio. And these are top shelf New York City studio musicians. And Horace is a wonderfully well-educated and young, enthusiastic dude. And we come up to the free jazz section. And, man, they could not conceptualize the thing.
So if it wasn't on the page, they couldn't play it?
Well, I mean, they had subliminated so many of their own impulses in order to be responsible, respectable, reliable, and hireable studio guys. You don't hire dudes that aren't going to be there early and do the job.
Who were the guys? Who's playing on this record? Because there's no credits of who the musicians are.
Well, we put some credits together somewhere. But the reason that there aren't the credits that there ought to be is because none of us ever assumed that these guys were on everything. You know, like the Wrecking Crew out in L.A.? They were just on everything. So, yeah, everybody knows who these guys are. And so Chris recently contacted Horace, and Horace couldn't remember who these people were. I'd see him. One of the first things Doc did was get me in the studio doing demos so I'd be comfortable in the studio. So I'd been seeing them, you know, I was doing all these vocals. Oh, the three tunes that I did for Doc at the foot of his bed are bonus tracks. Doc's daughter found recordings. Doc had said, "Scotty, go record these songs." And Doc's daughter, Sharon, found them, and so they're bonus tracks there. And another one of the vocal demos that I did for Doc, I did many, many. They'd write a song, and Joe would produce it, and I would do the vocal. All For the Sake of Love is one of the bonus tracks also. Anyway, so Horace didn't remember these people, and I don't remember them, but it may have been Kukulitz's finest hour. So Horace, and they try and blah, blah, blah. So Horace finally says, "You do it." And so Joe and I were somewhat intimidated. These are the best players. I mean, all the rock and roll records that are most dear to your heart, one of these guys was on it, if not more. So we held them in the highest regard you can imagine. But so we got them, and there's flang, flang, and we had string players in there, and squang, squing, squeak, and Joe conducted them banging and carrying on, and we got our little free jazz section, and everybody was delighted at the end. Well, yeah, man, we did that free jazz thing, yeah.
So when the record came out, what happened?
Well,
on Atco, by the way, big label, part of Atlantic.
Yeah. It was being held by Apple Records. This is not the computer folks. You know that, but some of the listeners may not know. When Apple snagged that Apple logo, there was a court case between Apple Records and these upstart computer people. Anyway, so South Atlantic Blues and James Taylor's first album were being held by Apple to decide which would be their first release. And Peter Asher was the A&R guy. Peter's sister, Jane, was Paul McCartney's honey bunch. And Peter loves James Taylor. Peter went on to produce most of all his records. Anyway, so while it's still there, Jerry, what the heck's his name? Jerry Weinbaum? No. Anyway, the head of Verve Forecast says, "Oh, I want the record." Now, Verve was the number one folk rock label. "I want the record, and I'm going to go be the new president at Atco, and I'm going to take it with me." So Herb had me sign with Atco, and Jerry never came to terms with Atco. He never signed a deal with them. So the record was at Atco and with no champion. So the next guy, Jerry Greenberg, came in, and of course, the other Jerry's pet project is the last thing he's going to promote. So it disappeared. However, Jasper Johns, perusing cutout bins, fell in love with this record. And I'm my partner Kukulis and I are staff writers at Screen Gems, and we are writing Soon, which was intended to be the follow-up to South Atlantic Blues. And this cheery little voice comes, a phone rings, "Oh, my friend loves your record." By now I was signed to Epic and had just done a beautiful single for them called "I Am," from the man who cried "I Am." Just a beautiful record, particularly the arrangement by David Woods. David's father was Harry Woods, the guy that wrote "Try a Little Tenderness." And David was the guitar player for Dave Van Ronk and myself. Dave did these beautiful... Barry Kornfeld, who's another folky, a great guitar player, produced the records for Epic. We did two singles for them. Anyway, so I'm thinking he's talking about the Epic record, and he says, "No, South Atlantic Blues, he loves it, and he did it inspired him, and he did a piece of artwork, and we want you to come see it. He's having an opening." And I'm imagining some day glow canvas with chicken wishbones stuck on it and watermelon seeds and some little place down in East Village. And East Village is not the way it is these days. Some little joint down there, but my mother, God bless her, had taught me to be polite. So I was polite to them. And pretty soon, "Oh, what's your address? I'll send you." I had already been exposed to fan mail, and I don't know what kind of fan mail you folks get, but I got some of the strangest. I mean, people would say, "Yes, in the third line in the second verse in South Atlantic Blues, in that space there, I know what you meant by that space. I know what you meant, and I don't like it. And I'm coming to see you." So I, you know, I knew not to give anybody my address. God help us. Anyway, so I gave him the address. The invite came. And my sweetie, who... Patricia, who much of South Atlantic Blues is about, my little Annie Bunch from the islands, and I jump in the car. We are definitely semi-savages, she and I, along with Kukulis and his sweetie Abigail. We get in a taxi, and the guy pulls up at MoMA, which is a big surprise.
Not a little gallery.
Oh, God, no, and not Avenue Z. So we go in there, and there is my record on the wall in a frame with every light in the world shining on it, and the most kind and patrician-looking folks.
Yeah, so Jasper John made a whole series of art.
He did three Scott Fagan records.
And so did that give new life to the record as a product?
I don't know that it did. I will tell you this, though. I've been wandering in the desert for many years, and I've been singing and writing throughout. But I was at UCLA in 1987 designing. I went to UCLA to learn how to design treatment programs for chemical dependency, to put one in place for the music business, which I did. So I went to UCLA and designed this program and got it put in place, and it became Music Ears. Anyway, so I'm out there. They don't know what my musical background is. If you're not a known musician, you're a wannabe out there, and it was really unpleasant, tough. People use this guy's another wannabe, blah, blah. I don't want him nothing. I want to sing. Anyway, so I would go to the UCLA library, to the art section, pull out various histories of Jasper Johns and look up my record just to remind me. It just meant the world to me. So I don't know that it sold any records, although I bet it will now, huh, because it's on the cover.
You say you were lost in the desert for a while.
Not lost, wandering.
Wandering, okay. A happy life in these intervening years?
Well, I have 5 children with 4 different mothers. So most of my life has been involved with raising children. I will tell you this. I wouldn't trade any of those children for $100 million. So if it was a question of, Scott, more material success with your music or one of these children, I'm going with the little one.
Well, certainly.
But it was tough. Yeah, it was out. It's been a long, hard, hard struggle. So my hope is that we can get some management and good agent in place here. And
you mentioned
and open
earlier
a channel for
your son, Stephen Merritt. Didn't know he was... You didn't know he existed, or you didn't know who he was until the year 2000? Is that right?
No, I'm in... Let me say this first. I'm talking to Stephen the other day. I said, yeah, so I'm going to WFMU to play some tunes and talk. He says, WFMU, that's the best station in the world.
Well, that's nice.
So that's what he said. The best station in the world.
Wow, that's very kind.
Yeah, God bless him. He means it, too. Anyway, so, no, I'm in Mississippi, Oxford, because the woman in my life at that time was going to Old Miss, and we had a little one holiday, and we were in Oxford. Previous wife called and said, there's a kid on the radio saying you're his father. What's going on? So it was Stephen on Fresh Air.
Huh.
So I called Fresh Air, and they gave me a booking agency out of Chicago. Called them. They gave me Claudia Gonson's number. I called her, and then we been in touch from that point forward.
Yeah. What an interesting world. I mean,
it's a fantastic world. So when I first heard Stephen's stuff, I had the weirdest feeling. I mean, melodically, our stuff, from my point of view, is pretty similar. I mean, I heard the stuff. I said, geez, I don't remember writing that. And why'd I go there rather than here? And is that song finished? So I had a really powerful subjective response to the tunes in a sort of proprietary way. Well, I don't remember when I wrote down. What the heck? Anyway, he's a great writer. He's a great soul. I think that Stephen views himself primarily as a writer that sings. I view myself as a singer that writes. I think we'll do some wonderful work together sometime.
Well, that will be very interesting. Yes. Scott Fagan is our guest. You can get more information at scottfagan.com, and the record is called South Atlantic Blues, and it is just coming out on the St. Cecilia Knows label. And thank you for visiting us so much. What an interesting story. Really just so interesting. And the record is there to hear all of this, because I do think your experiences are sort of on the record. You know, you can hear them in the songs and things. And thanks for coming, and I hope you'll play one more song for us.
Well, I'm really happy to be here. And honestly, I think you guys are the only folks that have been playing my tunes for the longest while. And so many people that love me love you guys. So yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. So In Your Hands is on. South Atlantic Blues is also the opening song for Soon, the rock opera. And interestingly, Soon was on Broadway, but I was fired, and the original director and my co-writer were all fired and barred from the theater. Anyway, so the director, Robert Greenwald, who's a fairly well-known activist these days, and I did it out in California at the Pilgrimage Theater for the Center Theater Group. And it opened with me out on the sidewalk singing this tune. And so we have a little woolen sack recording of it. And people are throwing money in the end. It's great.
Tell the preacher man to turn his head around, 'cause once a man has died, he's gone to rotting in the ground. You've got to tell the man to stop his superstitious songs. Spread the news of glory in the new life we have found. Tell the people man is dying while they pray. And the only life man will have is the one he's got today. Your brother will judge you by the things you do and say. Lies. We can't go on this way. Shake the people, wake them up. We've got to make them understand. They are the gods, this is the heaven. Nothing has been planned. Stop the superstition, truth is all we can demand. Spread the news of the whole world is in your hands.
So I'd written that Lyndon Johnson had proclaimed a day of prayer to end the war in Vietnam. And I thought that was the height of hypocrisy. I felt as though Lyndon Johnson was putting the responsibility for ending all of this killing on the American people and those that believed in prayer and their God, whatever God that might be. When in fact Lyndon Johnson could have ended the war any morning in 2 seconds.
Right. We didn't pray hard enough. That's why the war didn't end.
Yeah, exactly. It's on you. It's your fault.
Yeah.
And your son and your daughters are going and being maimed and killed, and it's your fault. So I wrote, in your hands. Also, Chris Campion, who, you know, the whole resurgence of South Atlantic Blues started with an anonymous fellow out on the internet. The nom de internet of Jakarta Jive. And he wrote the most wonderful things about South Atlantic Blues and the artists attached to that. And pretty soon, this is years ago, people began discussion boards and blah, blah, and they were saying the most wonderful things. Also, you know, I have a small fan club in Czechoslovakia. There are some people in Rotterdam. There's some folks in Iceland. All that say, when are you coming to see us? And I'm coming, I tell you. And maybe now I'll be able to go see him, hopefully. Anyway, so Jakarta Jive started this mumble and rumble. And then I get a call from a fellow named Hugh Deller saying that he wants to write an article for an English music magazine called Shindig. Before you know it, there's a 5-page article in Shindig with photos and wonderful, kind article. And then I get a call from a fellow named Chris Campion, who says he has a little label and he's interested in talking with me about re-releasing South Atlantic Blues. So that's the genesis of the re-release. Or in part, of course. It's only part of the story, but it's the part I know. This is called South Atlantic Blues.
You know the islands are perfect place for going away. Life's so easy there. You live from day to day, to day to day. The father of the missions, he once walked proud and tall. He must have seen too many Christians, 'cause now he's very small. The poor man's got no gods at all, not counting alcohol, not counting alcohol. You say that's news. I've got news for you. It's South Atlantic Blues. South Atlantic Blues. She lives in the alley. The hope gone from her eyes. Her dress is torn and dirty. Loving lips are cracked and dry. She sits and cries. My life's a lie. Her children think she's died. Her children think she's died. That's news. I've got news for you. South Atlantic Blues. South Atlantic Blues. She stands by the seaside, my love. She waits for me. And I can't help her as she wanders. How long will it be? I told her once we would be free from Charlotte Amalie. From Charlotte Amalie. Life's so easy there.